Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Excellent. Wonderful. It is so nice to welcome everyone here to Bevis Mark Synagogue for the final of our three-part series, The Famous and Infamous of Anglo-Jewry. We have hitherto had the opportunity to explore several, I would say, national or, in fact, even international figures that grew out of Bevis Marx, in a sense, all of whom at some point in their lives attended Bevis Marx and are, in that sense, I would say, often close to our thoughts here at the synagogue. But really, what's so significant about them is the way that they represent different paths of Anglo-Jewry, which I think makes them, in that sense, really representative and important to study, not only because they're famous, not only because they happen to go to Bevis Marx, but because they really do present different streams. And we'll reflect on that some more at the end of the lecture. Of course, the first lecture spoke about Daniel Mendoza, the late 18th century pugilist, and we explored the life of Sir Moses Montefiore, the great 19th century philanthropist. And tonight we're going to be talking about the perhaps the most famous of them all, because he really reached, thank you, Howard, reached national prominence, and that is Benjamin Disraeli, who of course becomes prime minister. And in that sense, they are really interesting figures. And amazingly, all went, you know, all went to this synagogue, and so that's something also interesting, you know, in its own right, to see how kind of even in this very synagogue, the different types of figures that came out of it. But I don't think that that's necessarily unique among Anglo-Jewry as a whole, though I do think it is significant in terms of the place, obviously, of Bevis Marx in the memories and in the life of Anglo-Jewry. Significant that we could have perhaps the three most famous Anglo-Jews all having actually gone to this synagogue. And of course, if you wish to be famous as well, I recommend you become a member too. Okay. I'm going to sit. I hope that's okay. So let's talk a bit about young Benjamin, presumably named Binyamin. And of course, I say that because he was born a Jew. Jewish law would say that he died a Jew as well, though he certainly didn't live his life as one. In fact, he lived most of his life as a member of the Anglican Church, right, as a Protestant. And yet, and you know, ironically, as we'll see, he is remembered as the first and only Jewish prime minister of Great Britain. He was shortly prime minister in 1868, I believe as part of a minority government, but his real kind of moment as prime minister was from 1874 to 1880, when he led the conservatives in a majority government during those years, when many significant events took place, for which he is will always be tied and connected, and for which he is remembered, either warmly or reviled, depending on perhaps different views. I would imagine in the room here we perhaps have some people who are perhaps familiar with Disraeli. I know that Zev has read quite a lot and even spoken about Disraeli himself. Is there anyone else here who considers themselves an expert? Yes. Was that too much? Too much to be called an expert? Good. I just need to know who to watch out for. Okay. You know, I'll really... the reason I ask that, or I say that, is because just from the outset, I don't consider myself an expert in Disraeli. We're going to go through different things that happened in his life. This is not meant to be an exhaustive kind of biography of Disraeli. But what I'm really interested in ultimately is that question that I framed the lecture with, which is the question of what exactly did this question of Jewishness as it relates to Disraeli, in part of how it made up perhaps his own identity to himself and to others, and also what he meant to Jews as well. And so we're going to be looking at kind of a couple different anecdotes from his life, different moments, looking at different things that historians look at when reflecting on these questions. But it's certainly not meant to be an exhaustive view of his history. There are incredibly, they say, more written about Disraeli than any other prime minister next to Churchill. And so he really has captured the fascination of historians, of students of history, in a way like other prime ministers have not. And so there really is a lot written about him, and people who really, you know, go into great detail on every little thing, every conversation he had in his life to try to, you know, pick up what did he mean by this, what did he mean by that. We're not going to do that. I want to kind of just give some kind of broad strokes, look at some kind of key points, and hopefully through that try to answer or reflect on some of these questions. Because really, ultimately, my objective with any of these lectures, in addition to kind of just, you know, interesting to educate people about these figures, really is that reflection that we have on what they mean to us, right, and what we can learn from them, and different things we can think about relative to their lives. You know, I mentioned at the beginning, you know, that it's this kind of irony in that he's kind of remembered as the first and only Jewish prime minister, not only because he of course didn't live as a Jew, and we'll talk about how that came to be, but also because if he in fact were a Jew, he wouldn't have been permitted to become prime minister. Perhaps the year he became prime minister, at that point it would have been allowed, but Jews were not able to take a seat in parliament as a Jew, or shall I say, to not swear a Christian oath in order to sit in parliament until 1858. And so, you know, several decades of his career precede that. And so if he, in fact, you know, really was seen as a Jew, or if he certainly had professed to be a Jew, he would not have sat in parliament and would never have risen to the position of prime minister. And so I think that's, you know, that question. And that's why there's all this kind of interesting intrigue in this kind of relationship to Disraeli as a Jew, or kind of our association with him, really is interesting, because, you know, his whole career wouldn't have happened if he actually had been a professing Jew. And of course, he wasn't. He didn't profess to be a Jew. So let's just talk a little bit about kind of some just broad overview of his life before we start talking about certain aspects in more detail. He was born in 1804 here in London, and was born to Jewish parents. His father, Isaac, I think I have a picture of his father here. Yeah, here's a picture of his father and his mother. I think her name was Bashevi, was the family name.
Yes.
Yeah, it was the family name. Descended from a Sephardic Italian Jewish family. And, of course, Jewish family, Sephardic, living in London, 1804. They were members at Bevis Marks. And so, in that sense, Disraeli grew up as a member of the Kahal, as some people on Facebook, you know, kind of tried to make the point, but he wasn't a member, he wasn't a paying figure, he wasn't able to vote, which is true. You know, as a child, he wouldn't have been, technically speaking, a yachid, as our membership is technically called, but as any child of members of the congregation, he was a member, you know, he was, of course, a member of the congregation. The family was not particularly devout, not that I'm the judgmental type, but he did not go to the synagogue school. He didn't go to even any of the private Jewish schools that had existed at that time. He went to private school. That's where he was educated. His father was not particularly involved at the synagogue. His father had become a writer, was interested in talking about history and political theory. Apparently spent a lot of his time at, I think, the British Library at that time writing, and was, you know, had a bit of kind of a reputation within literary circles for his writings. Did not have as much of a reputation within Jewish circles for his activities. But despite that, he was elected as a Parnas of the Kahal, as one of the leaders of the congregation. There are always several individuals that perhaps would have had that, position, and he declined to sit. As a result, he was liable to a fine from the congregation of 40 pounds. Essentially, the way it worked is if you were elected to office and decided you didn't want to assume that position, there was a fee that you had to pay. It could be, we have the sense from a letter that he ultimately writes to the Mahamad, to the board of the congregation, is that he saw this as nothing more than a extraordinarily thinly veiled attempt to just raise money from him. He was not a person that was involved in the congregation. He thought it was a bit ridiculous that he would have been elected to office to help lead the congregation, and he figured that they knew that and that he would decline, and that it was essentially a way to perhaps exact some additional revenue. Who knows? We don't know that. We don't know that for sure. He certainly wasn't the only person in such a position. And in fact, as soon as that happened, nothing really changed. He essentially refused to sit, and he also refused to pay. And that went on for several years. I believe that was already in 1813, if I'm right. In 1816, his father dies, Benjamin Sr., who apparently was a more devout figure. There you can see a picture of Benjamin Disraeli's grandfather, Benjamin. And he dies in 1816. In 1817, Isaac essentially cancels his membership at the synagogue. And so perhaps he didn't want to do so during his father's lifetime. But afterwards, apparently he receives another kind of his annual finta from the congregation with an added 40 pounds still attached there, and he decides, that's it, I'm done. At that point, officially revokes it. Benjamin Jr. is 12 years old, so before he even becomes a Jewish adult, a Jewish man, right, before he becomes 13 and becomes bar mitzvah, the family has left the congregation. What then happens, though, is significant, is they don't simply leave. A friend of Isaac recommends that Isaac convert his children, and he does that. He converts his children. This friend becomes their godfather, and they are baptized, and they become part of the Anglican Church. Presumably the argument being that through conversion, right, he'll have all kinds of opportunities opened up to him. There's not much benefit in being not part of any religious community. If you're not going to be part of the Jewish community, you should identify with this community and then have opportunities. And in that sense, it wasn't wrong, right? This will allow him access during his life that if he wasn't part of the church, he wouldn't have been able to gain access to. So people make a lot of that story. It seems like it was more the nail in the coffin, or the excuse essentially for which to distance something from which the family was already not at all really associated with in the first place, regardless of what we think about the 40-pound fee. But life goes on, and he grows up, and he will eventually in his life marry, and he marries this woman. Over here, Mary Ann Lewis. During his life, he accrues, during his young life, he accrues a significant debt And she is a widower and has, I think she gets about £5,000 a year as part of her that status in her life. And marrying her will relieve him of some of his financial anguish, and they choose to marry. But it seems that over the years, they actually form a lasting relationship. They're married for 30 years. In fact, she is quoted for having said, she called him Dizzy. That's how he's known as Dizzy. She says, "Dizzy married me for my money, but if he had the chance again, he would marry me for love." Which is, about how in the end it seems they really did form a meaningful relationship, regardless of perhaps what the original intents were. In fact, he has great quotes. I'm not going to be quoting them, but like, he has actually great quotes. One of his great skills in life was writing and oratory. It really is what will make his career. He is a great speaker. He really has the gift, and he will use it throughout his life. And there's all these great kind of one-liners that people quote from Disraeli. In fact, his career starts as a novelist. He will write novels actually throughout his life, throughout before his political, during his political career. He'll even write a novel between being prime minister and being prime minister, so the first kind of prime minister to then write. His novels are often also thinly veiled treatises either on his own ambitions or his political views or his views of other politicians or things that have occurred. And so people read his novels with great interest to kind of get the inside scoop on what maybe happened within a particular political intrigue that he had intimate familiarity with. Doing this will win him enemies, people who are not appreciative of having been kind of portrayed in his novels or kind of being told, about what occurs. But he does receive notoriety on account of his novels and becomes more kind of widely known through that. Though in certain political spheres, he's kind of looked down upon as, well, that's not what politicians do, right? Writing novels, I mean, like, what kind of, thing is that? And in fact, right, part of that is his career, is that he's not coming from landed aristocracy, right? He's not coming from kind of this, what you normally expect, politicians at that time to have come from. He's really a regular, kind of background, particularly difficult background at that time in England, for obviously for his ancestry. It's something that Queen Victoria will comment on, when he becomes elected to office. He says something, wow, how far he's come, right? And that really how significant it is that somebody like him, how unlikely it would be that he would ultimately achieve what he does. And he really achieves it, obviously, as a result of a series of turns of events, political intrigue, but because of the useful role that he can play as an orator. And that he can be used by others as their kind of attack dog for their political aims. And it allows him to become close to other political figures and to gain access and to kind of get into position. And as other people will then kind of during his career fall away or kind of have misfortune, all of a sudden he becomes, almost the last man standing. In fact, one of the times that he's kind of looking to form government, his government becomes known as the Who Coalition, because no one knows who any of them are. They really kind of become, and then throughout his career, he'll gain more fame and become known more widely. He begins a political career in 1837, or I would say his beginning of his successful political career. In that year is when he's actually elected to office. He had a couple previous attempts when he tried to be elected, where he failed. He ran as a radical, and kind of taking positions somewhat between what at that point we might call the Whigs and the Tories, will ultimately become part of the Conservatives, but will recast the Conservative platform, trying to incorporate certain elements that are attractive to the non-conservative party, right? And will ultimately bring the conservative party out of 30 years of not being in the majority, right? So he'll end up reshaping the conservatives in order that he can actually, that they can actually win an election. And so his political views will become kind of interesting, while at one time being a person who firmly believes in the monarchy, believes in the aristocracy, right? Thinks that it's kind of that it's their kind of role and it's the kind of the important function they play in protecting the people, right? And at the same time trying to find ways to change the way the political system works, right? The balance of between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and who exactly can vote, right? Who can be enfranchised to vote as well, and so trying to change the status quo while at the same time maintaining that sense and really presenting it for the working class of saying that your great protectors are going to be the aristocracy as opposed to, you know, kind of the middle income who really are not going to serve your interests, right? And so kind of trying to play off, right? Certainly the poor people don't have a vote, right? So the question is, you know, kind of how to position everyone, and he'll definitely be a traditionalist in that role. He'll be part of that conservative party, but a conservative party which is being a little bit perhaps more responsive to some other concerns within the country. That's a very probably poor job of really presenting as political platform, but at least gives a little bit of a sense of the kind of the shifting that's taking place. As I mentioned, he'll serve in the minority for a very long time, and then ultimately in the majority when he will become eventually prime minister. Just to show, along this way, obviously you ultimately have to own land. You have to kind of improve your credentials. Together with Marianne, they will purchase Hewenden Manor, which is now part of the National Trust. You can visit it. It's beautiful. It's really nice. And in fact, one of the coolest things about it is there you can purchase Disraeli beer produced by the National Trust. And I want to, I'll just read to you a little bit about what it says. It says, Benjamin Disraeli, the most unlikely Victorian prime minister. The refreshingly balanced Golden Harvest Ale is hopped solely with the renowned Fuggles hop and mashed with Maris Otter malt. I don't know what that means. But I'll read to you what it says over here. It says, Benjamin Disraeli, Earl of Beaconfield, novelist, statesman, and favorite prime minister of Queen Victoria, lived at Hewenden Manor from 1848 until his death in 1881. And it talks a little bit about his life. And it then says in the final paragraph, it says, this fine English ale, locally brewed in the Chilterns, was not available in Disraeli Day. If it had been, it would have shortly filled the jugs of that on that festive summer's day. So don't think that Disraeli actually ever drank such beer, but if he had, he certainly would have liked it, and you can get it in the gift shops. So Hewenden Manor can be visited. It's actually a worthwhile trip. Some of the paintings I've shown are actually hang in the home. It's interesting to kind of see where he spent his time, where he wrote many of his novels, and so on. And in fact, there is a church next door to the manor, which is where he is laid to rest. That's the church. And below it, or at the bottom of it, that is where he's buried. So he certainly, perhaps was born a Jew, died living as, or identifying as a Christian. Okay. So let's, great. Any questions so far? Yes?
Is there any truth in the rumor that on Colney Drain he used to come to the courtyard every month?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. Okay.
So, on the picture you just showed of the grave,
yeah,
it's very interesting because he's actually buried next to two women.
Yes, exactly.
His wife and Mrs. Bridges Williams, I think it is.
Yes, exactly.
It was a Mendes da Costa or something, who gave him 30 grand on condition she could be buried with him.
So you're not asking a question, you're sharing. Yes. Yes. Later in his life, he strikes up a friendship with a woman who also had left Judaism, but was quite intrigued with kind of his rise, and as we'll see, some of kind of his roles within dealing with questions around what he would call the Jewish race, and as a result, left quite a lot of money, which actually helped a lot of his also his debts. But the deal was that she would be buried by him. Yeah, so they had apparently a very warm friendship between them. Yeah. Okay. So let us continue. Okay. So let's say this. As I mentioned, I started out. I'm not interested in him just because he was born a Jew. I mean that's nice, but I wouldn't be like, oh, he was born a Jew. Let's associate Bevis Marx with him. Right, on a very crude level, we'd say he was an apostate. Right. Had left the community, not someone that we would, in a sense, celebrate as the ideal congregant of Bevis Marx. And yet, it is interesting to reflect on perhaps what he meant to other Jews, and that's something which changes over time, as well as what Judaism meant to him, which really maybe didn't mean much to him at all in a personal type of way, but we'll see it did mean something to him. The historian that's probably focused the most on Disraeli's Jewishness is David Cesarani, who really just passed away a year or so ago. This book was just published about a year ago, posthumously, from the important historian Cesarani. Anyone who writes about Disraeli talks about his Judaism, but he wrote a book really just exploring that question, really going into great detail. He's clearly not much of a fan of Disraeli in general, I would say. And so anytime you read any work, there's always a bit of a grain of salt. Though I think a lot of his points about what to make of the different episodes in Disraeli's life that relate to Jews, I think he does a good job of trying to put them in perspective and to understand what they meant or didn't mean or how, what perhaps to make of those events, as opposed to, let's say, other historians who really are experts in, British political history or just Victorian England, don't necessarily have the primary focus on just kind of his Jewishness and therefore draw different conclusions or make different assumptions about these different episodes. And so he's at least trying to present one perspective of how to understand what all of these things meant to Disraeli and ultimately to Jews. Okay. It's a good book. It's a worthwhile read, and it's actually not long at all. So I would say the following. I'd say biographers of Disraeli, in terms of his Jewishness, are interested in several different kind of episodes or things that happen in his life. And so we'll talk a little bit about them. One, of course, is his personal background and his ancestry. We'll look at that in a bit. They look at his travels. He actually travels to the Middle East in 1831. They look at his novels, the things that he wrote, to try to, kind of read in between the lines to see what is he telling us, perhaps, from what he writes. They look at his involvement in Jewish affairs, politically, in this question of the ability of Jews to join parliament, which will take place during his life. They'll look at his different Jewish connections, particularly with Lionel de Rothschild. And they'll look at some of his political positions, and again, what those positions may or may not mean about his Jewish allegiances, or not, depending on whether you're an anti-Semite. So so we'll look at some of those. So those are some of the questions that I want to look at. And they essentially, different narratives will present themselves from looking at these events, right? One narrative will try to present Disraeli as deeply connected to his Jewish identity, that it truly was kind of his self construction, right, was wrapped in the sense that he was of Jewish identity, and perhaps we'll take that so far as to say that he continued to maintain a sense of Jewish allegiance, okay, if not actually practicing Judaism. And the other narrative that we'll look at a lot of these events as being you know, in terms of his Jewishness as being largely irrelevant to him, and that it almost being accidental and just trying to read something into it where it doesn't exist as well. And so probably the truth lies somewhere between those two extremes. Cicerani certainly puts it to one extreme of kind of, or at least is closer to the side that says it didn't mean as much to him, while other people, you know, see everything that he did as being Jewish, but I would say that would probably the view of the anti-Semites. So that's where we'll kind of, the truth is somewhere between those two. So what I'd like to do is actually to look at those different kind of elements, those kind of six categories, to talk briefly about them, and kind of just pull out a little bit of kind of what it is that people talk about in relationship to them. So, of course, with his personal background, right, there is the recognition that he grew up, that he was born a Jew, had Brit Milah. We have his circumcision in the synagogue records. He was circumcised as part of the community. And we know, you know, it was a member, his families were members of the community until he was 12 years old. We know that his father was not particularly engaged in the community, clearly, but that his grandfather was more so. His grandfather, having come from Italy, having come, I think, most recently directly from Venice. And this question of really what his ancestry is. In fact, Disraeli writes a little bit about his ancestry, talking about his illustrious Sephardic roots, as we all do. With illustrious Sephardic roots, and he presents this as coming, you know, this long line of ancestry on his father's side. Historians have shown that that's not true, and actually he perhaps has some more kind of important Sephardic ancestry maybe on his mother's side, but that's not really how he presented it. And historians, again, kind of look at, did he willfully, kind of this presumption that he willfully misrepresents his ancestry to make it more glorious than perhaps it was, or perhaps out of a sense of his own glory, could not imagine that his ancestry wasn't glorious and perhaps was just unintentionally seeing his past in the way that he saw it. But he did see himself coming from an important Sephardic line. In fact, apparently, one time in Parliament, when someone kind of spoke pejoratively to him from having Jewish ancestry, he mentioned or he commented to them that, you know, while this, you know, British person's ancestors, you know, were a bunch of pagans, you know, his ancestors were serving in the temple in Jerusalem, you know, so kind of this kind of characterization, right, of that we come from the Jews come from this, you know, very glorious, you know, ancestry, whether or not ultimately there is a second truth or a more, or as some argue, to write a more, or as Disraeli perhaps even commented, kind of a more perfect version of Judaism. Certainly the Jews, right, did bring this great glory and that he should be respected for that. And perhaps it was his way, as some people think, of trying to say that while I may not be of kind of the landed aristocracy of kind of deep roots within this country, I certainly do have greatness in my blood and I can walk amongst any of you as well. Now, does that mean that he is proud of his Jewishness? Or does that simply mean that he's recognizes that he comes from Jewish stock and kind of trying to embrace that for the purpose of positioning himself as a person who should be able to, you know, fraternize with earls and so on. So again, that's how exactly do you look at that? That's, you know, kind of the questions that people will ask in thinking about Disraeli. What is interesting is he doesn't deny it. In fact, he can't deny it. I mean, his last name is Disraeli. He actually changes his name. The name really is De-Israeli, De-Yisrael, right? De-Israel, as we would say even today, right? De-of, right? Israel. So perhaps the family was, you know, the Israelite family, De-Israel, right? In the Portuguese. And he takes away the De, just makes it Disraeli, right? So he takes away the little apostrophe in the name, and it just reads Disraeli. But he doesn't change the name to, you know, Beaconfield, right? I mean, he'll become the Earl of Beaconfield, right? Meaning, right, he doesn't take on, a very English name, you know, as other Portuguese Jews did when they anglicized their beautiful Portuguese names. Yeah. No one here in particular. Okay. I apologize for the inside jokes within the room, but if we can't have fun here, where can we have fun? Okay. So that is one of kind of the issues surrounding Disraeli is his use of his Sephardic ancestry, particularly in that there's a bit of misuse of it, and the fact that he doesn't actually live as a Sephardic Jew. And so all these kind of funny things about his kind of use of it, but at the same time, he can't really deny that he was Jewish either. So kind of why skirt the issue? He kind of tries to almost embrace it and perhaps use it to his benefit. Again, whether that's him doing it deviously or sincerely, right, is kind of one of those questions. Now, what's interesting about it is that he does spend a bit of time traveling, not much of his life, but he does, in 1830, travel, so in his 20s, and he does make his way to the Middle East. What Cesarani points out, and what's kind of significant to him, is that when he visits these places, he doesn't visit the Jewish communities, right? So when he goes to Jerusalem, he might speak of that maybe there are Jews somewhere, but he doesn't actually go and interact with them, right? When he goes to Italy, where his family has come from, he doesn't interact with the Jewish community there. They're really kind of, on one hand, he kind of maybe is or isn't aware of it, but he doesn't engage with it. Which at least means that perhaps in his 20s, it's not something which he's, sees himself part of. I mean, you would think if he's visiting the places perhaps where his family had come from, you know, you would check into the community and be like, hey, do you have any Disraelis here? You know, there's not any kind of interest on his part to kind of engage with that or explore it. You know, he goes to Jerusalem and he doesn't, you know, go into the old city to meet the Sephardic community, you know, that lives, you know, in Jerusalem. So there's kind of this sense of him being really detached, you know, from his Jewishness, from the fact that he's going to these places, some of these places that have, you know, very identifiable Jewish communities or Jewish quarters, right, what we call ghettos, right? And yet he doesn't go visit, he doesn't, and in his writings, he doesn't really talk, he doesn't say, oh, I saw, you know, he'll describe different kinds of peoples that he sees in his journeys, you know, interesting groups, but he doesn't describe Jews. And so again, for someone if that was kind of something that was really meant something to him or that was interesting to him, you would have expected that he would have, you know, engaged or at least described or somehow taken note of Jews in the places that he went to. But he doesn't. So what to make or not make of that? Well, that's a question. Yeah.
Where were these visits? Middle East, and where is that on the timeline?
So he does this around.
Fit with his political.
So this is 1830. So it's kind of before his before he starts his political career, kind of just before. So it'd be 1830s where he'll start running for parliament. Okay, so he's kind of at this youthful age. It seems like he's still trying to find himself. Maybe starting to do some writing, right? But he's still kind of floating a bit and decides, hey, I have this opportunity to go on this little adventure, and he takes it. So that's the question of his travels. He doesn't travel much else during his life. He does go to Paris a couple times, and we'll see, he's going to go to Berlin. But he doesn't travel much during his life. But he does write a lot. He writes a lot of novels. This isn't really kind of the sufficient time to go into it in great detail now, but he does write novels, and there are different themes, I would say, just to kind of reflect on his novels. You can still read them today, that emanate. One of the themes that often comes is this kind of rags-to-riches story, right? Often there'll be a lead character, a young man who feels that has it within him to do great things if only he will be given the opportunity to do them, you know? And it's clear that it's, you know, or at least what people say, you know, it's the way he sees himself. You know, he sees himself at these stages as kind of, that he has it within him to be great, and yet at that moment he isn't, and kind of that frustration perhaps as a young man, of feeling like there's so much he wants to accomplish, and yet he's, you know, how do I do that? How do I get about that? And so it's all these kind of stories, intrigues, again, often dealing with relationships and these marriages. And again, you can kind of see himself in it, you know, and trying to, this young man trying to position himself in such a way that he will be able to climb the ladder. So that's one kind of thing that comes out of his stories. The other one is that he actually has Jewish characters in his stories. You know, we'll kind of use them to talk about, you know, different races around the world, and kind of talk about the Jewish race. And so there's this, what some people say, kind of this embrace of his Jewishness. I mean, really, writing a novel with Jewish character, right, is really, you know, is not trying to just kind of spin. I mean, that's really kind of engaging with it in a substantive type of way, if whilst being obviously indirect about it. He's not necessarily identifying himself as those characters, but he's bringing them in. And what he seems to do within these stories, and it's why the lady that you mentioned before kind of really kind of takes a liking to Disraeli, is that he presents these characters in positive ways, kind of talking about the, you know, kind of the Jewish race, not as kind of the way that perhaps some people at that time see Jews, in some kind of negative or, you know, problematic type of way, but showing, you know, wow, this great, you know, race of people. And yeah, one of the things we'll look at kind of towards the end, there is a bit of complexity to his embrace of this idea of race, which on one hand is obviously something he's embracing because he's not living as a Jew, but he is part of the Jewish race, right? But that question of race is obviously a fraught kind of way to think about things, in a way that we don't necessarily think about peoples today. And so we'll kind of reflect on that, and kind of the positive within his kind of embrace of this notion of like Jewish race, but obviously there'll be challenges to that representation as well. And so what exactly to make of his kind of writing in of Jewish characters, you know, again, and what that says about him and what Judaism means to him, is again, it's a difficult question to answer. But let's talk about some of his actual interactions with Jewish issues, particularly as his role in government is the question of the oath of office. Until the time of Disraeli, one can only stand in parliament if you take a Christian oath of office. Now, already in the 1830s, that has changed in the city of London, right? So you can become a sheriff of London, right, as Sir Moses will, without having to take a Christian oath. But if you want to become part of the national government, you do. And so Jews are not able to do that. And in fact, in 1847, Rothschild is elected as one of the representatives of the city of London to be in parliament, but he's not able to take his seat because he is unwilling to take the oath. And there is a push among the Liberal Party to pass legislation that will allow him to take office while perhaps saying a different oath and so on. The Conservatives are opposed to that, right? They're more the traditionalists, right? They're opposed to kind of changing the status quo. And famously, Disraeli advocates for it. Disraeli does advocate for it, which causes him a lot of ire within his own party, kind of within the senior membership of his party. But he does speak on its behalf, though ultimately it fails, right? It doesn't pass, and that's the end of the story. Though in 1858 Rothschild will be elected, he'll again try to assume position. And at that time, what's attempted to do is to change the law that can say that the House of Commons and the House of Lords can determine their own oaths of office, right? So it can become kind of an internal decision on what the oath of office should be. So it's no longer
One of the challenges has always been that the House of Lords was opposed to these changes. So if you kind of pass a law, the House of Lords would say, well, we don't want to change that, and so it would make a problem for the House of Commons. And so what happens is they pass a law saying, listen, let's kind of separate the two. House of Lords, you guys can keep, you know, your Christian oath, but let's leave it to the House of Commons to determine their own oath. And that will pass. Cicerani argues that Rothschild does not play really an active role. He doesn't feel that he really advocates for it, that he doesn't fight for it, and feels that essentially Disraeli is mostly indifferent. But again, there's other people who say, no, he did, you know, vote for it. You know, so they try, you know, there's a kind of differences on kind of what to take of it. You know, there's a kind of the sense of if his Jewishness is important to him, he should have been, you know, really pushing it. He didn't play that role. Did he feel he couldn't play that role? That maybe that would make it work? Who knows? We don't really know. And again, so what exactly to make of his role within these affairs is difficult. But we do know that ultimately it does pass, and Rothschild does become the first Jew to become an MP. And that happens in 1858. So from 1656, when Jews first actively live here, till 1858, when we become full, one could say full citizens of this country, it takes about 200 years until that kind of full kind of political acceptance in this country takes place. Okay. Now, as part of this, it is interesting, and I think this is part of the question, is his relationship with Jews. Now, what seems to be the case is that throughout most of his political career, he has nothing to do with Jews. It's not like he has a close relationship with Jews. It seems that Jews kind of keep their distance from him, perhaps sensing that his, you know, his identity is clouded. And so there isn't this kind of Jewish embrace of Disraeli as a Jewish politician. He's really not seen that way. It is all, the community doesn't have much to do with him. In fact, it seems the most Jews are more on the liberals, right? They're not part of the Conservative Party, right? The traditionalists that would seek to bar them from greater involvement. And so there isn't this strong embrace of Disraeli from the Jewish community during his life. They seem that they're mostly kind of have nothing to do with each other at all. So for all of the things where Disraeli kind of writes about Jews, and that doesn't lead to him being engaged with living Jews, right, in a meaningful way. The person with which that will change is Rothschild, because Rothschild will form a friendship with Disraeli, and Disraeli, in his older years after his wife passes, will apparently dine with the Rothschilds on occasions, and so there is this kind of warming between the two. And part of that is probably part of the changing landscape of Jewish political allegiance, where Jews will be increasingly conservative during this time, in part because of perhaps the certain positions of the conservatives in terms of global affairs that perhaps Jews will feel more strongly about and will identify with the conservative positions. Perhaps, as we'll see, some of the attitudes towards Disraeli from non-Jews will influence Jewish views of Disraeli as well. And that'll be something that I want us to reflect on in a little bit. But let me just talk about the sixth issue, and then we'll kind of circle back to that, which I think is going to be an important point. People read into his political positions as prime minister, as kind of, you know, what to make of him vis-a-vis Jews. I would say most of these readings in are probably done by anti-Semites, right? Kind of saying, oh, he takes this position because of his Jewish allegiance. And I would say, broadly speaking, all of them have to do with the increasing role of the British within the Middle East. Okay? One of the major things that Disraeli does is he orchestrates a purchase of shares within the Suez Canal. The British make up about 80% of the shipping through the Suez to India, obviously because the Indian subcontinent is a British colony. And so there's a lot of trade, obviously, going through the Suez Canal, right? Much easier shipping than going all the way around Africa. And yet there will be challenges about their position, concerns that perhaps there will be other nations that will want to exert greater influence over Suez that aren't in British self-interests, the Russians, and so on. And so there'll be an opportunity to purchase a large amount of shares in the Suez. And what he does, instead of going to Parliament to seek approval for the purchase, he takes a loan from Rothschild in order to make the purchase, and then goes to Parliament to approve it and to pay back Rothschild. Now, technically speaking, Parliament could have said, we didn't approve this, and we don't, and Rothschild would have been out his money. But ultimately, it is accepted, but there are people who are really upset. They feel that, you know, that he's acted completely independently, right? He hasn't gone through the appropriate channels, right? He just, you know, decided, you know, I'm going to do this. And yet, ultimately, that seems to have been, right, a positive, you know, step in that it does secure British access to the Suez. But it does increasingly involve the British with the affairs of the Middle East, particularly when it comes to issues relating to the Ottomans and to the Russians and spheres of influence that ultimately, right, have a lot to do with trade and economics, as we shall see. Just a sense of kind of his sense of tradition. He is very close with Queen Victoria. They're famous for having a very close relationship. She actually at one point even visits Hughenden Manor, right, which was unique. Something that she always had wanted was to be an empress, because, well, you know, she wanted to have the same standing as, you know, her relatives, the Tsar, and so on, and she kind of felt like her position meant that she was subordinate to them. And he passes, for a bill to be passed, they'll make her the Empress of India. And she will actually begin to sign her name, right, as, you know, Queen Victoria and the Empress of India, right, that becomes part of her thing. But again, it's this interest that he has in the notion of empire, right? So he's seen as part of, you know, the imperialist, right? That he kind of embraces that notion. But really, probably the most significant political crisis or international crisis of his day has to do with really the intrigue between the Ottoman Empire and the Russians. The British are very interested in ensuring the continuity of the Ottoman Empire, because a weakening Ottoman Empire means a strengthening Russian Empire, that they feel is not in their best interest, that the Ottoman Empire, they have a much stronger kind of sphere of influence there. Status quo is always good, and would actually prefer to maintain that. This will get problematic when there will be a series of revolts in the Balkans against the Ottomans, and the Ottomans will put it down. There will be some massacres that will take place, but of course the Balkans is Christian and the Ottomans are Muslim, and so there is an outcry of saying, you know, we must defend the rights of Christians, and that is something that the Russians embrace, right? So we are going to defend, you know, Christendom, and it puts the British in a very awkward position, because if they, in a sense, support independence, it means growing Russian influence and a weakening British position. Disraeli fights for the maintenance of continuity within the Ottoman Empire, and some accuse him of doing this because he's not really a Christian, right? Because he's a Jew and doesn't care, and they call him an Orientalist, right? And they say, you know, even look at him, right? He doesn't look British. Look how Oriental, right? He looks. Right, whatever that means, right, and claim that he is he's not acting in the interest of Great Britain; he's acting in the interest of Jews, and so he ultimately goes to a congress, what's called the Congress of Berlin. He meets Bismarck, and there's an attempt to negotiate some kind of truce. And what he actually does, in order to force the Russian hand to even get them to go to the Congress, is he gets Parliament to declare war and to actually begin amassing troops as a way of saying, we are going to go to war over this if you Russians don't take your troops out of the Balkans. Right? They had gone in there, in a sense, to secure that area. And he does. He begins amassing the navy and the army to go to war. And there are people in England who are opposed. They say he's a warmonger. You think you're just bluffing, but you actually might be really leading us into war. But it does. It forces the Russians to come to the table and ultimately forces the Russians to move out of much of the territory that they've done and to retain the status quo. And so he'll ultimately then go back to England as this hero, right? Some people will say reckless hero who ends up kind of getting lucky. Other people will say, wow, he's what a shrewd operator. He really works the situation just perfectly. And thanks to him, the British Empire, retains its position of primacy. But again, throughout this, particularly during this episode, there's a lot of anti-Semitic invective being thrown at him from the liberal side. And that will drive people like Rothschild to become increasingly part of the Conservative Party and drive other Jews to become part of the Conservative Party, where they see the Liberal Party as being anti-Semitic, right? And that their positions, right, do not conform with kind of the Jewish value system. And so they will increasingly become conservative during this time. And I think that will really become the point that I think has a lot to do with the lasting legacy of Disraeli within Jewish circles, as we'll see. But essentially, just to briefly recap, all of those kinds of things we spoke about really lead people to thinking, to try to look at Disraeli and to say, what did his Judaism mean to him or didn't it mean to him? And you saw with each of them, you could kind of go in different directions, I would say almost depending on what your overall sense of who he was and what it meant to him, right? You can look at everything and say, oh, look, you see these Jewish connections, or you can say all of them and say, those actually don't tell you anything about what Judaism actually meant to him. And that as I mentioned, that's Ryan's view. He feels that it didn't mean that much to him. But the question is if it didn't mean that much to him, how is it that it did become something that where so many Jews did identify and did kind of say, oh, the first Jewish prime minister. And he says a lot of it has to do with that final, his years as prime minister itself. And that's really where kind of he goes with it and says the role of anti-Semitism in crafting identity. First of all, perhaps it's Disraeli's own identity, right? The fact that even during his very first election campaigns when the few that he lost or some people wrote about his Jewish ancestry as trying to, say, he's not fit for office, already kind of perhaps brought to his light that as much as he was identifying as a Christian, he couldn't run away from his Jewish identity, and in fact, perhaps needed to do something with it, because denying it obviously was impossible, and yet people, continued to invoke it, and so he needed to somehow engage with it. But certainly, as in his later career, when it becomes of great prominence, right, that's when you'll see increasing anti-Semitic invective thrown his way, and then perhaps that's what draws Jews to identify with him so much is, once he is being barraged with anti-Semitic ridicule, right, they say, well, he's one of us, right? Meaning whether or not he identifies as a Jew or lives as a Jew, right, the fact that he has the same challenges that we have as Jews means that there is a sense of solidarity with Disraeli, and perhaps ultimately, make Jews see him as a in a sympathetic way and with a way that they can identify with him, because whether or not he lived as a Jew, people still continue to see him as a Jew, and therefore his story becomes the story of all Jews. And so there's that kind of interesting kind of shift that will take place, not so much necessarily as a result of anything that Disraeli does, but as a result of what his antagonists. Which is worthwhile to think about. What I'll say is that it's a complicated story because of kind of these changing attitudes over his life. The distancing that he perhaps has at one stage in his life to closer identification. What exactly that increasing identification really meant to him. But what is clear is that in retrospect, he did mean something to Jews. Did kind of, symbolize in a sense that, even Jews can achieve this, right? Because even if he wasn't technically a Jew, legally speaking, in terms of the eyes of England, the fact that he was still seen as a Jew and yet still achieved political success shows that Jews can achieve political success, right? And so kind of through that way, there's kind of this sense of, you know, him being perhaps in that sense almost that they identify him because of anti-Semitism against him, but then use him as a way of showing, look what British Jews can achieve, right? So kind of this twisted, kind of interesting way of using his legacy as a way of ultimately then showing how great Great Britain is, right? That Jews can achieve these kinds of positions, even though their only identification with him as a Jew is because he was, you know, had to deal with anti-Semitic barbs against them. So it's a kind of a complex kind of relationship. Just about 5 minutes left to tie this up. When we started this series, first, does anyone have any questions? Okay, fine.
I've got one quick one. I'm a bit confused about the identity. If he'd been Jewish if he hadn't gone for a baptism and been buried in a church.
Well, he did. He was baptized when he was 12.
He wouldn't have become prime minister, though, would he?
If he was never elected, correct. He wouldn't have been able to be elected as an MP.
So then how does he show us that a Jew can become the Prime Minister?
Because people still saw him as a Jew.
Okay,
so technically speaking, the fact that he wasn't Jew is what allowed him to get elected. The fact that people saw him as a Jew and he was still elected shows that Jews can achieve that.
So the non-Jewish MPs would still regard him a Jew even though he was baptized?
Yeah. Some did, yeah, exactly.
So why did his parents then, if they were members of the congregation here, they sanctioned that he was 12 years old?
Well, as I mentioned, they had this falling out.
They had a falling out with the shul?
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, you missed the first few minutes. I'll have to catch you up.
Right.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
What was his relationship with the rest of his Jewish family?
I don't know.
Thank you very much. That was excellent.
Thank you.
Although I know you haven't finished, but just on that point about baptism, and I bring a perspective from a Christian faith.
Yeah.
I'm quite interested in the Godfather, the man called Sharon Turner, who was a friend of the father.
Yeah.
The baptisms took place in secret. So today is a week today in 1817 was Benjamin Disraeli's baptism. So it's 200th anniversary next Monday. But there'd been baptisms before that of brothers. There were three baptisms took place. They took place during the week, not on a Sunday and not on a Friday. They took place at St. Andrew's Holborn. But they didn't seem to be taken, certainly not in the case of Benjamin Disraeli, by the rector of the church. There's a lot of some dispute about who actually did the baptism.
Okay.
They talk about a Reverend Thimbley, who they sometimes confuse the name or say it was a different person, Thimbley, but he's not the person listed as the rector.
Hmm.
Sharon Turner, perhaps talking about it, and as the Godfather, says he's about 7 years old, not 12. Personally, I found it very difficult to understand what the technicalities. The baptism is one thing. Becoming a communicant member of the Church of England is something else. Often it's done at the same time, especially if they're going to be as old as 12 years old. But I wouldn't have expected it at seven. To be a communicant member of the Church of England, you would normally go to communion classes. And Benjamin Disraeli talks a lot and draws on his life and experience and drama, but he doesn't talk a lot about that service and about the circumstances there. You asked the question about relationship with the family. He was extremely close to his sister, Sarah, and Sarah supported him enormously until she died in 1859 and made his career. He said, dies, that he had the wish that she would close his eyes in 1881. So I can't quite get my head around. He certainly took communion. He was buried in a church grave.
Yeah.
But was he ever confirmed? I just wonder. And it's quite an important point in the Church of England. But nobody, it's in nobody's interests to, in the Church of England, I would have thought, to try and work that out. Well, there's probably no record. I should imagine. But you could actually, if you delve, you might find something in the London Metropolitan Archive. Mm.
Okay.
Can I just say one other aspect? Is that there's this wonderful triangle with Bevis Marks at an apex, if you like. And then there's St. Andrew's Holborn on the other side of the city. And I have talked to the rector at St. Marriott Hill. The rector at St. Marriott Hill is Reverend Rose Hudson Wilkins, who came in part from being the chaplain to the clowns in Dalston, at St. All Saints Dalston. She has another role, circus clowns, but she has another role in that she's the chaplain to the Speaker of the House of Commons, who is the MP, more or less, for Beaconsfield, and who is Jewish.
Not a clown.
Interesting.
All the connections, yeah. Very interesting. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Just to kind of put a little final context on this, and this will be Jewish context, one of the things we looked at at the beginning with these figures was kind of the identification of them with the four sons. Famously at the Haggadah, we talk about the four sons, the wise son, the wicked son, the child that does not know how to ask, and the simple son. And I said we would, for pedagogical purposes, we perhaps would characterize our different figures with one of them. And we spoke about Mendoza as being the simple son, right? Kind of simple Jew, maintained his Jewish identity throughout his life, but wasn't particularly engaged with it. We saw Sir Moses, I thought maybe as the child that does not know how to ask, in the sense of not the way that often it's portrayed as kind of also simple son, but actually as he wasn't a scholar, he wouldn't be the wise son, but he didn't ask questions. He went at it. He was really committed. He lived his life, with purpose and conviction. And, that's, I think, a great characterization for him. With our final figure, we have two choices left. I struggled with this because on one hand, he was a very wise figure, but from a Jewish perspective, I'm not sure we could call him the wise son. What I thought about the characterization of wicked son was interesting because in many of the commentaries, they often focus on about the wicked son because he says, what is all of this to you, right? That's the language that the Haggadah quotes as him as saying, and the response, the retort of the parent is, when you say to you, it means that you are not identifying with the Jewish people, and if you had been in Egypt, you would not have been redeemed with the Jews, right? Because he's saying you and not me. And so with Israeli, right, he identified as a Christian, right? So in that sense, he fits that characterization of the Rasha, right, as someone who doesn't identify with the community. But what I thought, there's this translation of obviously a wicked or evil, but not necessarily want to say he's evil, right? And that's certainly what he was a child when it happened. But also, I think, some of the commentaries that I like to say, maybe this is kind of very modern type of thing, they say, there's a fifth child. He's the one who's not even at the table, right? And so the Rasha is at least he's at the Seder table. And so I felt like in that sense, the Rasha in that sense is a good characterization of Disraeli because he's not identifying with the community, but in this, he's still at the table somehow. And I thought maybe in that sense we could put him as the Rasha. What I like about thinking about these figures is not because, they all went to Bevis and they're all famous, but in reflecting on them, it's really seeing how they represent different paths that Anglo-Jews took. And that I actually think they are great kind of examples of three different directions that Anglo-Jewry took for acceptance, for their engagement with society. On one extreme, you have Disraeli, who in order to become fully part of England converts. And he's not the only one. There are many, many, many Anglo-Jews, particularly in the 19th century, that convert, right? It is their ticket to being part of the mainstream. And I think in a lot of ways he represents that group of Jews that convert perhaps out of necessity, maybe others out of conviction, right? But that feel that that is where their future lies, is through conversion. But interestingly, you convert, it doesn't mean that you forget where you come from, or it doesn't change where you come from, and so then you always have that kind of complexity to your identity. And that is one direction, right? We can't deny it, that Anglo-Jewry takes. You have another approach, perhaps at the other extreme, which is, shall we say, Sir Moses, who lives a devoutly Jewish life in his travels, all the way to the Middle East. He brings a ritual slaughter with him, right, so that he can keep kasher. When he decides he wants a country home, right, to be a good Englishman, he builds a synagogue, right, in Ramsgate, right? He does everything he needs to do. He even sets up a rabbinic school there, so he has minyan, right? Meaning he really goes all the way to the extreme of maintaining, all of his Jewishness, right, to the best of his ability. And then you have someone like, Mendoza, who never revokes, his Jewish identity. He's always proud of his Judaism, right? He speaks about his Judaism in some of his writings, and yet, it seems like his Bachan school is open on Saturday. Right, is open on Shabbat, perhaps after services, but nonetheless. And so, he's kind of this middle figure that says, he's going to fashion his own Jewish identity whilst maintaining his sense that he is a member of the Jewish community. In fact, he's buried in the, in the Spanish-Portuguese cemetery. So, he's kind of that other figure. And I think each of them kind of reflect different routes that Anglo-Jews have taken, from the one extreme of those who, shall we say, in a sense, leave the Jewish community, to those that maintain, shall we say, strict adherence to Jewish tradition, to other people that maintain their Jewish identity, and very proudly so, but perhaps don't maintain strict observance to, Jewish tradition. And in that sense, I think, really reflective of the different routes that Anglo-Jews take. And it's so amazing, right, that each of them reach national or international acclaim, and each of them do come out of Bevis Marx, and that through, this historic synagogue, we can actually see all the different routes and paths that Anglo-Jewry has taken. And it's one of the things I love so much about being at Bevis and about reflecting on Bevis, is that through this one synagogue, we can, in part, understand the totality, or many elements of Anglo-Jewry, and that when people visit this synagogue, it's a really useful platform through which people can reflect on Anglo-Jewry, but really what I think is most important is reflect on themselves, right, and reflect on their own identity or questions of identity and what does that mean. And it's actually through studying through some of the figures in the synagogue that I think it challenges us to think about, where do we fall within this kind of this spectrum of Disraeli to Mendoza to Montefiore. And I think that, ultimately that's the role of a living Jewish community, is the way that it forces us to reflect on our own lives and our own identity and where we see ourselves within that spectrum and where we'd like to see ourselves within that spectrum. And, in that way, I think it's so important to have a community like Bevis living and active and perpetuating, because it acts as a useful mirror to our own lives today as well. And so as we kind of close out this series, I want to just say how much I appreciate those of you that have attended, those of you that, many of you who come to Bevis Marx, right? It's actually through strengthening Bevis Marx, through strengthening, the SMP community, that we will ensure that, that these values and these ideas will play a role in the future of Anglo-Jewry, in the way that Anglo-Jewry identifies itself and the way that it thinks about itself, right? And that it's actually through strengthening Bevis, through your coming to Bevis, through your being members of the SNP, and so on, that you actually can play a really important role in ensuring that what the SNP represent, right, its values, will play a determining role, or certainly a role, right, in how Anglo-Jewry's future will ultimately unfold. And I think today is probably maybe more important than it has been in a very long time that the SNP has a voice and has a place within kind of this reflection that Anglo-Jewry is going through about what its future will look like. And so I really want to just say that your being here tonight is part of that, and that I invite you to continue to be involved and to become even more involved. And again, in whichever way along this spectrum you find yourselves, maybe not in the all the way to the Disraeli function, though we do actually welcome everyone to support us and to, in any way that that you can. And I think going forward, that's something which is really important. Now, just gonna, as closing to the series, this is really the end of kind of the year of programming. Of course, next week is Tisha B'Av, a day of mourning. Interesting that it coincides with Disraeli's baptism. So I do invite people to come. Tisha B'Av here is extraordinary. The way we do it at Bevis is, it's one of a kind. The way we drape the synagogue in black, low candles attached to the seats themselves. The melodies are something that we believe go back to Spain itself. It's hard to express what it Tisha B'Av is at the Spanish Portuguese. And I would encourage you to come in the evening. In the morning, we have the keynote, the lamentations. Each lamentation has its own melody. Imagine hundreds of years for that to evolve, and every single paragraph has a distinct melody that's used for it. It's a really special experience. I encourage everyone to participate in that, the eve of Tisha B'Av, as well as in the morning. And that's basically going to be it then for our kind of, obviously, we have daily services and Shabbat services throughout the summer, but in terms of our major programming. Next year, just to kind of highlight, we're going to be launching a new history series. One of the comments someone gave to me in preparing this series was, well, where's the women? I thought about whether including some women in the series, but I felt that these were all individuals of national renown. We'll talk about it in next year's series, right? You didn't have women that achieved that type of renown at their time, and to try to put them in felt almost cheapening what their contributions were. Right, we'll evaluate them for what they were. But there were Sephardic women that did really important work here in London, as well as other Spanish Portuguese communities during the 19th century. Figures like Emma Lazarus in New York, Rebecca Gretz, who was involved in the Spanish Portuguese community in Philadelphia. Of course, Lady Judith Montefiore here in London. And so next year, when we do a kind of our monthly series, we're going to be focusing on the women of the Spanish Portuguese and kind of learn about their contributions and their values and the role that they played within the SNP as well, because of course where would we be without the women? So that's a series I'm really looking forward to. It's something that this series actually helped me start thinking about, and so I'm really excited to kind of do my own research over the summer and then have a chance to study about it more with you in the year ahead. So thank you all for coming, for participating this year. We've had a really good year at Bevis, kind of really kind of taking that step forward. Next year, we're hoping to really launch forward and to make a major mark on broader London and Anglo-Jewry. We have a lot of things developing in the works to take it a step forward. And so I'm really excited to do all of that together with you in the year ahead. So thank you very much, everyone.
Thank Rabbi Morris for his inspiring talks. He keeps coming up.